I wrote in the blurb this week about the question of why we would need heaven when we could go to the beach. And I thought I should acknowledge that I know that the beach isn't everyone's idea of heaven. Because one person's sand between your toes is another person's agony of sand in your swimsuit. And that's just the way we are. Yeah, when you're a pasty ginger, your words, not mine. Yeah, that's true, Trev. I hadn't even thought about that one. But, if we could allow it to serve as a metaphor, perhaps, that would be all right. Let's do that. It's really about a way of trying to think about heaven. And I wanted to read us a little bit from the beginning of the lead story from Christopher McLean's, the May 13th issue, which has the bold headline, "What if heaven is real? Why so many people, including scientists, OMG, suddenly believe in an afterlife?" Anyway, listen to this. The article itself is called The Heaven Boom, and the subtitle is "From Best-Selling Authors to Scientists, Why Do So Many People Suddenly Believe in an Afterlife?" Death, it seems, is no longer Shakespeare's undiscovered country, the one, quote, "from whose bourne no traveler returns," close quote. Not according to contemporary bestseller lists, dreams and visions of the afterlife have been constants across human history, and the near-death experiences, now known as NDEs, because who really wants to spell near-death experience in a tweet? Now known as NDEs, of those whose lives were saved by medical advances, have established for millions a credible means by which someone could peek into the next world. Lately, a fair-sized pack of witnesses claim to have actually entered into the afterlife before coming back again to write mega-selling accounts of what they saw and felt there. Afterlife speculation has become a vibrant part of the zeitgeist, the result of trends that include developments in neuroscience that have inspired new ideas about human consciousness, the ongoing evolution of theology, both popular and expert, and the hopes and fears of an aging population. Heaven is hot again, and hell is colder than ever. And then that, of course, references the next paragraph, which is a statistical explanation of that heaven is hotter and hell is colder, basically saying about the same number of us that used to believe in heaven still do, but less and less of us believe in hell. And the idea of an afterlife now includes a much greater range of options than just heaven and hell in our culture. Among them, what one academic has called an unreligious afterlife, which is an interesting idea. We live inescapably in this culture. One of the things that I love, though, about this age in which we get to live is that what this culture embraces and includes and considers, I think, is expanding. It feels like it's expanding culturally. And I think there's real riches there. I think about our conversation last week with Jordan Bighorn as our guest about the Isle of Amour movement and the culture of our First Nations and some of the things that are going on there. I think the whole panel was fantastic. Jordan blew my socks off. That's the beginning of a longer conversation for him and I think. We'll keep getting together. I think there's lots to learn from him. And that's a sort of an indices, I suppose, or a pointer to some of what I'm talking about, that shift. One of the reasons I think that's significant in the context of what I want to consider this morning is because this fascination that we have with heaven or with the afterlife is both current. This guy, Eben Alexander, this Harvard neuroscientist who wrote the book Proof of Heaven, that is still number one on New York Times sellers paperback nonfiction list. It kind of launched this whole conversation about the afterlife into center stage in the culture again. And it's kind of been always perking along, but it's kind of been perking along in the religious subculture, right? It's kind of been a thing that the religious people think about and talk about and believe in. All of a sudden, it's closer to center stage in the very contemporary edge, the very contemporary Western edge of our culture.
But the conversation is not necessarily a contemporary one. The conversation is an ancient one. Interesting collection of essays is called Centering Anishinaabe Studies, Understanding the World Through Stories. It's a collection of essays about how, in this case, particularly indigenous stories hold and transmit deep knowledge about our perceptions, about our values, about our worldview, that I want to reference in a moment. But when I do, I think it's important to keep in mind this idea. I think that as people, and most of us in this room would have this as our heritage, people of European descent, we seem to have, and I would say of European descent not just in terms of race, but in terms of mindset, worldview, the way that we think. Sometimes I think that those of us who have that as our heritage have inherited as part of that heritage and kind of an inordinate rationalism that just knocks the whatever out of our stories. So we believe in this mindset. We believe our stories to be true, but we feel this compulsion to fortify them, with doctrine and to fortify them with dogma. And even then, we don't act like we trust them. But if we go to ancient stories and the cultures that carry ancient stories, one of the things that we often find there is that these are people groups and cultures that don't necessarily seem to believe or need their stories to be true in some way that's about rational veracity. They are able to trust their story implicitly without that prop. And that's very interesting. All that to say, that's more the cultural context for this story, which is from this collection of essays. A hunter's arrow found and downed a moose. As the hunter was gathering wood for a fire to prepare the meat, the hunter discovered all sorts of wild vegetables and fruits as well. Overwhelmed by the bounty, the hunter didn't know who to thank, but felt a bursting need to thank someone. So he simply looked around and said, "Thank you." This is where giving honor or religion came from. I have a friend who became a follower of Christ during the years I was pastor in another community, and when she told me her story for the first time, it felt like it was this same story in a different context. She was out on the lake one day in their boat at the cottage, and the sensations and smells and environment that she was in said something like this to her. She needed to thank someone, and she didn't know who. And she stood up in the boat and yelled, "Yay, God," which freaked her boyfriend right out of his mind. But it was, same thing, right? Same thing. Another teller of tales, William Shakespeare, talking about the same realm, I think, says, "Such tricks hath strong imagination that if it would but apprehend some joy, it comprehends some bringer of that joy." What it points to, among other things, is that there's this ancient human inclination to probe the nature of the universe and to probe it in a way that takes us beyond just the things that we can get at in this space that we occupy. We seem to be pretty much wired to ask big questions about the place we call home. We want to ask, is it safe or is it dangerous? Is there anybody else out there? And if there is, are they good or are they bad? And regardless if they're good or bad, have they been calling out to us? If they've been calling out to us, we sure hope they're good. If they have been calling out to us, how have they been doing it? How are they doing it now? How have they done it in the past? Is the way that they've done it in the past like the way they do it now? We just don't ever seem to leave this conversation. The alternative, of course, if we were going to make this an either-or conversation, which leaves some things out to be sure, but the alternative in many ways is that we are alone in the world, that this is all there is, and that all those ancient stories that suggest otherwise are superstitious nonsense, and that the modern narratives of near-death experiences are pretty much can be accounted for as the happy discovery of a very lucrative sub-niche for publishers. Look, people buy this crap. If we're alone, in the universe, I find it a little bit tough to explain our apparently pan-cultural drive to delve into this realm of questioning. That would seem insistent to the point of insanity from an historic point of view. Like, keep coming back to the same set of questions if we don't suspect that there's something there. And I think it's also a little bit difficult, if we're alone in the universe, to account for the shared shape of so many of the stories that point us beyond ourselves. It seems to me that it would be more likely, given some of those things, that there is something more to the cosmos than what we can see or touch, that there is a there as well as a here, if you will, and that those two have something to do with one another. They're connected somehow. And so we have all these stories. We have ancient stories, we have literary ones, we have contemporary ones, and they can feel like they mesh with some sort of built-in longing for a lot of us. Yeah, like they're pointing us somewhere important. When we gather in this context, the context of a community of people exploring belief, and in particular exploring belief from the vantage point of Christian faith and history, the sacred text that we reference the most is the Bible. And the ancient stories that I want to reference this morning are recorded in the Bible. A lot of what our sacred text in Christendom carries is so old, and it's from a culture that is so distant from ours, that it's honestly really hard to know what to make of the stories. And one interesting way to come to those texts because of that is to come to them consciously making room for mystery, constantly making room for possibilities, sort of the same way we have to come to an essential story, like the story about the hunter and the moose. So instead of treating our ancient stories in our sacred text as though they were the doorway to the props of doctrine and dogma, think about them as narratives that are at the deepest level true, and that's not about rational veracity, that open into the mystery that we can't seem to stop asking about. If we start there, then we can sometimes, with Shakespeare, consider the possibility that if we want to apprehend, which simply means get a hold of some part of what might be happening in the story, then we need to get our mind involved to consider what sort of being might be the bringer of the mystery that we sense in the story. And that can take us down some pretty intriguing paths. So there's a curious pair of biblical stories that might help to open this idea up for us a little bit this morning. The first one is from Exodus 17, the bigger book that this story is a part of. It kind of gives away the theme, Exodus. It's a bunch of people leaving somewhere and going somewhere else. And chapter 17, the people, Moses and the Israelites, are out of Egypt. They've been wandering around in the desert for a while, something that the story accounts for by saying they were traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. It's not going that great, which is an interesting pairing, you know. And they're tired, and they are angry. And in particular, in Exodus 17, they're angry because they are thirsty. They're pissed because there's no water. And they're on the brink of an insurrection. They are right on the edge of a riot, of a coup, of a Hebrew spring. They're on the edge of an uproar because there is no spring. Sorry, I should have left it alone, but I didn't. Tim, you can add it as you wish. So Moses, as a leader, finds himself in this terrain that one of our contemporary 20th century business gurus, Peter Drucker, calls the Peter Principle, or somebody else called it the Peter Principle, but it came from him, this idea that in organizational life, if we stick around long enough, we will inevitably be promoted beyond the level of our competence. So here's Moses, right, kind of going, whatever I signed on for, it wasn't this, you know. And this fascinating thing in the language of the story, where he, of course, God talked him into this whole thing in the first place, so he goes back to God with the problem. Fair enough. And what he says to God, as we have it in our version of the text, is, what am I to do with these people? This is important. If we were talking about leadership, we would start there, and we would talk about what happens inside a leader's mind and spirit and strategy when you start to regard those you lead as not yours, not ours. You stop thinking communally, and you think of them and me. And all of a sudden, the whole thing starts to shift. Anyway, what am I supposed to do with these people? It's important in our context for a different reason that we'll come to in a moment.
So God tells him to do something that I would say is undeniably weird, deeply unscientific, for sure. He says, you know, there's this rock over here. I want you to gather the people. This is where we come back to the divorce that he starts to launch, and he's complaining to God, what am I supposed to do with these people? God says, well, you're supposed to gather them because they're your people. So get in front of the people and whack the rock with your staff. Right? This is going to be great. But he does it, you know? And that's how the story goes. So he whacks the rock, and of course, if we know the story, we know that what comes out of the rock is water. Now, I realize that we could explore this moment in the story from the vantage point of the Western rational mind. We could consider where they were geographically. We could ask ourselves if there's still a spring there. We may discover that there is. I don't know. Some have. We could talk about what happens in terms of geology there. And could he have actually just whacked the thing and boop, and out came the artesian and so on and so forth. We could kind of go down that whole path. And we have. But rather than doing that, because among other things, that feels to me like it's defaulting back to that inordinate rationalism that I talked about that takes the stuffing out of the story. Rather than that, let's just let the story sit where it is and regard it as trustworthy entirely apart from its rational plausibility for a moment. Okay? Let's just see if we can suspend that insistent part of our view of the world. If we do that, one of the things we have to acknowledge is that that story is not just weird, but that's a weird rock. Like, that something strange is going on with the rock in this story. And if we stay in the story, of course it keeps going, and if we keep reading about this bigger journey, we learn lots of interesting things. The meandering keeps going. So if this is still moving from place to place as the Lord commands, that continues to be a strange set of commands. A lot of meandering. We will learn about the trials of the Israelites. We will learn about how God is patient and doesn't give up on them, although he comes really close more than once. We will learn about how hard it is to lead people and not crack up in the process. There's just lots of important and interesting themes in the story. But we don't hear anything more in the story about the rock until it shows up again 1,000 years later. This is 1 Corinthians 10. Paul's writing to a church, and one of the things I like about the Corinthian letters when I read them these days is that they feel like they're written to a church that's not that different than this one, in many noteworthy ways. He's writing to this church, and he refers to this story about the rock, and he says that those who traveled out of Egypt, and this is from our translation into English, quote, drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Wow. What the heck? So, first the story's weird, and now what do we even call this? Because no matter how hard I try, I cannot find Jesus in the first story in a way that satisfies my rational mind. He isn't named. He's not even hinted at. There's not even a prophetic shape in the language of the story that says, oh, by the way, a baby's going to be born and you're going to call him Messiah. You know, it's not like this kind of, doesn't have this shape of I can connect those dots like we sometimes experience with Isaiah as a prophet. It's just the people are thirsty. God tells Moses to thump the rock. He does. It provides water. They drink, full stop. So it seems like Paul is reading another story inside the story. And it's a story about Jesus. Or to put it another way, it's a story about God taking another shape at another point in history. The shapes have some things in common. They have in common themes like the giving nature of God, the sustaining inclination of God, the thirst-quenching, soul-thirst-quenching quality of the presence of God. I think those things are there. Paul's pretty bold about it. He says, Jesus is that rock. So how do we address what feels, I think, to most of us like a gap? This might be a way into that mystery. What if we consider that essentially Paul is saying that Jesus was there in that ancient story without anybody in that story using his name?
or saying it was him, or acknowledging any of this in any way. If we work with that for a bit, we pretty much have to consider the question, if it's legitimate at all for us to think of Jesus as being present in that ancient story about a water-giving rock, then where and how else might he have been or currently be present? In what other unnamed ways might God be present to us? I've talked here before about one of my really influential teachers, Dallas Willard, saying that God is the E and E equals MC squared, which is, I think, really just another way of saying the same thing. If we want to think really hard about the nature of the universe, the cosmos we occupy, we have to acknowledge that there are some things going on that are beyond us. And not the least of those things is the thing that we use a word like energy for, this angry star that burns and doesn't burn up, that keeps us alive, gravity that holds us down but doesn't squish us flat, the fabric of time being something that seems to get thin in certain experiences of near death, and when it does, most of the people who come back and talk to us about that see something like light and experience something like the reception of love. There are lots of different ways we could think about this thing that we call energy. And we could come to a lot of different conclusions, and there are lots of us at this time, in this age, that have concluded that whatever it is, if there's an it, there isn't any meaningful linkage between there and here. One of my favorite bands, kind of a neo-folk outfit called The Bills, Canadian band, really thoughtful bunch of guys, virtuosic musicians, very intriguing songwriters, just fantastic band, really like this band. Latest album's called Yes Please, and Stephen Fry, who's the lead songwriter in that band, kind of was in this consideration of apocalypse space a little bit, I think, when they made this album. And he's got a number of those songs that kind of consider those themes, including a song called This Is Not the End. And part of that lyric goes like this: ain't no cause for concern, rivers rage, fires burn, we're all spinning, who knows where, forces move us, and they don't care. And a little later in the chorus, he amends the lyric to be: ain't no cause for concern, oceans rage, cultures burn, we're all spinning, who knows where, forces move us, and they don't care. It's one conclusion we could come to, even if we acknowledge that there's something beyond us, is that that something is indifferent, that whatever it is that throbs through all of creation, whatever it is that's the spark of life, whatever it is that's the sustaining drive behind the whole thing, it's impersonal and uncaring, and it's over there, and we're over here, and these two things have nothing to do with one another. It's not the picture we get from the Genesis poem and narrative. And I want us to take a second to think of that Genesis story like the Anishinaabe story that we referenced near the start. I want us to try to think about it not like a Western historical description of events, because it's not. And rather to think of it like a story that can be trusted. Not because it lines up with our rational explanations about events, but because it is, in the deeper sense of the word, true. And if we think about it that way, that story can carry us into the presence of the energy that gives life to everything, but it does it in a rather unique way in this regard. It gives that energy a name. And not only does it give that energy a name, but it says that the inclination of that being is to be for us. To be for what has sprung from the imagination, the power, and the presence of that being. And if we keep on chasing down Paul's idea that he launched in 1 Corinthians 10, we find him talking in Colossians 1 about how God has made known among the Gentiles the glorious riches of this mystery. Gentiles, remember, means everyone for a writer like Paul. God has made known among the Gentiles the glorious riches of this mystery. God has made known among everyone the riches of this mystery. Not the in-group that has the same take on God that the writer has. Not even the group that the writer is perpetuating a certain framework for belief in God to. But everyone. It's Paul's way of saying that something that time has hidden is being made known. It's being made clearer. And he's not only clear about the mysterious nature of God, but clear that this is a mystery that predates the beginning of what we might call time. In Romans 16, he calls it the mystery hidden from long ages past. But that's part of the character of this mystery. To put it another way, it's like Paul is saying that God, as revealed in Jesus, isn't actually, and this is important, isn't actually a new element in the story. But rather is the unfolding or unveiling of a truth that has existed from before time that is now taking this unique shape. He was there in the rock, remember? So here's the thing about going to the beach. As I promised, right? If Jesus is in some mysterious way in the rock from which the water comes, and if the beach is really just a great big collection of very small rocks, why is it that we would think of God as being present here but absent there? We don't need to come to church to find God. We don't need to come to church to access heaven, to even make progress around these big questions. Because we're not leaving God behind when we leave here. It feels kind of dead obvious when you say it all compressed like that, doesn't it? But it's funny how often I have conversations with people who went to the cottage for the weekend and weren't in church, who talk to me like they're expecting me to treat them like they've been naughty or something. I told Davis and I were having a conversation about this because we were talking about the bills and that lyric and what I was going to take from it and whether that was fair to the art maker or not. So we kind of ended up talking about the whole thing. And he says, kind of counterproductive, isn't it? You know, like, I mean, you kind of like people to show up for church, wouldn't you? I said, well, you know, of course. But way more than that, it matters that we keep moving into the mysterious terrain that we've been talking about this morning. Here's the connection, though. And this is not unimportant. Remember how when God talks to Moses and says, you got a problem and you need to address it as a leader, and here's what I'd like you to do, that he takes on Moses' inclination when under duress, when seeking God and saying, what do I do, God? He takes on Moses' inclination fairly directly to do that by isolating himself from his people and turning this into them and us, them and me. He says, I got what you should do, but you got to do it with your people. You got to do it with your people. Why? We can speculate about that a lot, but one of the things I want to suggest is because when we probe this realm, we are in terrain that is too big for us. It's too big for us rationally, and it's too big for us relationally, and yet it's what we're made for. So this is a mystery in itself. But one of the things that seems to keep coming up in the story over and over again, in all kinds of different shapes, at all kinds of different times, is that this is not actually a search we were meant to do on our own. That we're not actually made like that. So I know where this emotion comes from around this idea. Probably it comes from the heartache that I hear over and over again of what comes of isolation in the human experience. We're just not made to live like that. But we live in a time where there's just one thing after another that sends a message that you can prop yourself up in ways that mean that you don't really need anybody, or virtual somebody will be fine. Passenger, this guy out of the UK, this singer-songwriter that I've been listening to a fair bit lately, has this one hook in one of his songs where he says, our girlfriends are all gone because we watch too much internet porn. It means love when you have silicone and strap-ons. It's a little graphic, but Steve and Amy can explain all that to their children later. No, my kids didn't catch it. The point is that there's all these ways in which in things that are so essential about our humanness, in this case sexuality,
that our culture just sends us messages that say, you can actually deal with this realm of life, this realm that has so much power and that has so much mystery and that comes so close to the experience of the self. You can do it on your own. One of the reasons I like this guy as a songwriter is not because of what might sound good in an isolated excerpt like that for his gratuitousness, but for his insight. Because the first line of that little sentence is, our girlfriends are all gone. Our relationships are broken. Because we're living in them as though we could handle humanness in isolation. We could explore the things that move us deeply alone and be okay, and we can't. And if we want to mess with and engage with, and we do want to mess with and engage with mysteries that open into the things that are beyond us. In this case this morning, the illustration of that is heaven. One of the things we need to remember, whether we do it in visible community like this, or that we do it in some other shape, and there's lots of legitimate shapes for this exploration, we're not made to do it without community. And if I was going to try to make an argument for showing up for a gathering like this, that would be the essence of it. Is that this is an expression that reminds us that that's true. And that we need it. Whether it's this shape or some other shape. This is partly what I think, and I'll leave us with this, what William Blake's long poem, Auguries of Innocence, is trying to probe. It's trying to say there's a linkage between these things we see all around us in everyday life and the shape of the person and the shape of the cosmos. And of course the opening stanza is the famous one, to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. But the poem goes on at considerable length, 23 stanzas, I think. Anyway, it's long. And it's just, the next stanza I think is about how a guy treats a horse and what that says about the shape of the human. And it just kind of keeps going like this through the created world and ways in which we interact with it and encounter it and what that says about what's going on in the shape of the person and the shape of the world. So, next Sunday, whether you're here or whether it's a beauty and you're off to the beach or wherever your idea of a little hint at paradise might be, see if you can carry a little bit of this mystery with you. Just see if there can be a little echo of this. Both the hint at something beyond us that we're hungry for and that we're looking for when we do those things. And also the question, am I trying to do this on my own? Or am I willing to do the strange things that God sometimes calls me to do in this search with community of persons? I think if there's some echo from that, then our time here has been well spent.